To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Juan Gonzalez on the Young Lords, and for his best-selling book, Harvest of Empire, just call us, 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Call us, 1-800-444-1977. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.
This is Ursula K. Le Guin, and you are listening to KBOO, the cheerful voice of social conscience, KBOO, Portland.
You're listening to KBOO's All Thrills, No Frills, Volume 2 special programming campaign. Check out all the great special programs we're bringing to you in February and March at kboo.fm/thrills. Help us reach our goal of $17,000 by March 25th. You can go to kboo.fm/give or text us. Type in KBOO to the number 44321. For the thrill of it all, keep listening.
Pacifica Radio in San Francisco, this is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, we spend the hour with legendary investigative filmmaker John Pilger. We'll go deep into the latest round of China bashing and threats of an all-out war with China. We'll speak with John about Ukraine and the counteracting the big lies coming out of Europe around the war. And of course, we'll speak with John about the plight of his good friend, the founder of WikiLeaks, Julian Assange. There's a lot to talk about. All that and more coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. Whew, we got John on the line, and we are happy to have the multi-Emmy Award-winning filmmaker John Pilger. He, in my opinion, is among the most important political filmmakers, investigative reporters of the 20th and 21st century, from Vietnam, yeah, 50 years ago, to Palestine, to atomic war, to now the U.S. War, the global war, the war of the West against China. John has been really on the front line. There's so much more to say. John Pilger, I'm delighted to get you back on the show. Welcome.
And it's very good to be back on the show.
All right. Well, listen, can we start with just like a little get your take on the story that was released by the Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Seymour Hersh regarding the sabotaging of the Nord Stream pipelines, which were constructed to carry natural gas from Russia to Europe. You have any thoughts on this? Do you buy this story? Is it a possibility? Why would it be significant?
Yes, I think it's an extremely important story. I mean, of course, with Cy Hersh, you have to take all of his work on faith, because his style is simply not to publish his sources. And that's how he gets the sources. He gets, and his main source in this story is somebody very close to the operation itself. Sy has such an extraordinary record of truth-telling that my understanding and instinct about this story is that it's absolutely true. It's been suggested that the British probably played a role in there too, but who knows. But when you just stand back a little from it, Dennis, isn't it extraordinary? Truly extraordinary that a major piece of infrastructure belonging to, built by Russia, belonging to Germany, I think a Swiss company operates it, coming through Norway, can be blown up, which it was blown up. I mean, there's no question about that. It was blown up. And all we had at the time was some disinformation that the Russians themselves had blown up their own pipeline. Absolutely ridiculous. I think it's an important story because it'll further educate many more people on just what is happening in the world at the moment, and especially in Europe, and especially, of course, around Ukraine. But the fact that all attempts at peace, all attempts at a security agreement, a real security agreement in Europe, have been sabotaged by NATO, especially the United States and especially the United Kingdom. And now that the pipeline itself, which is in many ways simply a symbol of it all, because here is Russia having a great resource such as natural gas, Germany needing the natural gas, and the and perfectly legitimate trade between the two countries, and geopolitically logical trade between the countries is sabotaged. How can we allow that to happen in the 21st century? So let's hope that this story begins to wake people up. They certainly need to wake up in Europe.
Well, you know, when the pipeline was blown up, there was no real expression of outrage about the terrorism carried out against the Russians. There seemed to be among an expression of a bit of joy among certain folks, like the Undersecretary of the State for Political Affairs, Victoria Nuland. She seemed to be happy about the situation. Well, why would she be so happy? It's terrorism.
It's even more arrogant than they used to be, Dennis. Biden himself said before it happened, when I think just before Russia began its invasion of Ukraine, he said that if they do that, well, then the pipeline, which the effect of the pipeline will be no more. They own so much of the space in which we are allowed to think and analyze and be informed. I suppose we call it the media, whatever it is. But they feel they can say virtually anything. So that's the answer to your question, I think.
All right, well, let's... speaking of saying everything, there are so many arenas I want to bring you into, but let's start with the China bashing. Of course, one of your most recent films is The Coming War on China, prescient as have all your films been in various ways. But let me maybe start off the segment this way. A U.S. general, it's from, I think, the Times or somewhere, U.S. general warns troops that war with China is possible in 2 years. General Michael Minihan, who oversees the Air Force's fleet of transport and refueling aircraft, cited the 2024 presidential elections in Taiwan and the United States as part of his rationale. Can you unpack? How do you see his rationale here? He obviously is expressing the will of the U.S. government.
Yeah, I mean, I think we have to just temper it slightly, Dennis, by saying there's an old tradition amongst American generals and admirals to shoot their mouths off about the first thing that seems to come into that space occupied above their medals, and we've admirals have been doing it for the last few years. Now the general is doing it. I'm not sure that he should be taken on face value, though it does show that the whole system of geopolitical stability is at risk when people, senior people like that, can make statements, make their predictions. What we do know is that the U.S. has been gaming an invasion of China for at least the last decade, longer. I've seen one of these game plans, and many of them, which China is invaded. There's a kind of shock and awe to it. The preparation is certainly there. Of course, things are changing so rapidly. First of all, the technology of weaponry is changing, and rather frighteningly so. But the Pentagon knows that the Chinese have developed missiles and other defensive weaponry that can take out whole fleets of ships. So this is the kind of almost uncivilized brinkmanship that we should not even be entertaining at the moment. there should be negotiations, talking between countries about trying to find some common ground. The truth is very simple, Dennis. It comes down to the fact that the United States, since the Second World War, has become so used to being the dominant superpower in the world that it simply cannot even entertain the idea that it may be equal or number two even. It's not going to be particularly number two. It'll be probably more or less equal in some respects. It remains the greatest military power, but it's not the only one. We have that cliche multipolar world. Well, that's what it is becoming. There are many countries now developing fast all over the world. There's still too much underdeveloped, still development, still too much poverty in countries that should be prospering. But that said, the progress among countries that languish for many years, and in spite of some very bad politics, has been quite stunning. So we will, the next generation will most certainly have, whether the Americans like it or not, there is going to be a multipolar world. They're like King Canute, you know, who tried to turn back the oceans. It's just not going to happen. The danger is what they might do in trying to make it happen. We're seeing that already in the forced and provoked confrontation with Russia over Ukraine. And it appears they want something with China too. It's beyond irresponsible. We know that.
Yeah. Absolutely. We're speaking with John Pilger, filmmaker. We're talking about, among other things, China. John has many, many, many films, and he's got a recent film about the coming war in China, which is so prescient and important in this context. Now, I don't know why I... Every time I think about the U.S. shooting down the blimp, I think about the Hindenburg in terms of, like, the destruction of the possibilities when you shoot and or, you know, when you have a total conflagration as opposed to the possibility of, like, talking to each other. But it is sort of amazing, given the history of blimps, of the knowledge that each country has about the other country's extensive spying at all levels. Anybody remember U2? This is... When you say it's sort of, you know, they say Trump's insane, and maybe he is, or he's dangerous, but how dangerous is that policy? Shoot the blimp?
Yeah. Look, Dennis, it's... the shooting down of the balloon, I thought, was so farcical.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, it's a balloon. And what was it finding out? That there is planes across the United States? And I don't know what it was finding out, and who cares? And as a single balloon, it couldn't have been very important, even if it was trying to spy on something. But this dramatic shooting it down, I mean, it's sort of infantile. Looking at the other side, some 400 U.S. bases effectively surround China. They start from Australia and go all the way up through the Pacific Islands, through the Philippines, Japan, Korea, Okinawa. There are drones and low draft ships on the doorstep of China day in and day out. And on the other side, there's a balloon. You know, it's this kind of, it's hypocrisy doesn't count for it anymore. It's a blindness that that I think much of the world, if not most of the world, now understands that the United States sees itself in complete isolation. And that everything else has to be reckoned to be a threat. And the fact that it is the threat, that it provides a threat to countries like China, is not even part of the discourse. This is kind of insanity, and I don't think it's one that's shared by most people. I think most people understand it now. I've felt sorry for Americans who really believe in their government, their media, and all this exceptional nonsense that has been propagated for since the 19th century. Isn't it time it ended? And that in the United States, regardless of what government, regardless of who's the president, isn't it time the United States started living with the world it's in? I think it's a reasonable question now.
And absolutely. And I mean, the way so many different variations on the theme of China bashing, but we've seen this around COVID and the blame game around COVID. But what we know, John, when it really comes to manufacturing biological agents that can be dangerous and have escaped multiple times from U.S. Labs, one would, it's hard to sort of throw that one at China when the United States is at the leading edge of biological warfare. Wouldn't you say this is something to be be considered?
I don't know the answer to that, Dennis. I've read around the accusations on both sides, and of course everything is possible. There have been forms of biological warfare. There certainly was very strong evidence of it during the Korean War, but I simply don't know. What I do know is that there's some extraordinary things happening in the world and actually in China, but we're not allowed to know of them. The fact that that country, that society, has changed its imbalances, its class imbalances, that it's eradicated serious poverty completely, is kind of remarkable in the extreme, and probably in such a short time and not much more than a generation. And yes, there have been casualties, and yes, the government is not perfect, far from it. But that all this has happened peacefully, and I know when I was in China the last time, I was astonished because I hadn't been there for 25, 30 years. The changes were extraordinary. Well, isn't this our mission on this earth, to improve the lot, our lot, to improve the lot of our environment, if that's at all possible, to make things fairer for us in living? It's so interesting. And yet, information about it, basic information about it, is lost in this, as you rightly call it, China bashing constantly. As I say, at the beginning, Dennis, I believe now it's infantile, and that we're getting to the point where we, and I'm not sure it's only we, but certainly powerful nations, and especially the United States, have to grow up to grow up and become full-thinking adults, because this is ridiculous. Every day we're asked to believe fairy tales as news. You know, the few times that I turn on the television, and if I'm in the right mood, I'll fall back laughing. If I'm not in the right mood, then it has quite a different effect. This is meant to be the news, and we get a tsunami of this every day. What's going on?
It's the perfection of stenographer journalism is what it is, and corporations.
Yeah,
answer. I'm asking the questions here. Why don't you answer that question? Why? How did we get here?
I don't know.
Because I can't.
Here's what
speaking of lessons that should have been learned, we are this is sort of an interesting segue. I think we are coming on the 50th year since the Vietnam War. Now, you were no stranger to that war, and your reporting at every level was extraordinary. Is the way we're treating China sort of an indication that there were no lessons learned?
I think yes, there were no lessons learned, or I'd put it slightly differently, and that is that the great motor of the most powerful nation, the United States, is that of imperialism, a term that has been with human beings for as long as they've organized themselves into entities and countries and governments, but which has been most potent in the last several hundred years. I think the United States is almost a 19th century country. It's an imperialist country. All that is missing, the admission that they are imperialists. Imperialists used to be very proud of what they did. They'd go forth into the world and civilize the natives and do the best with the natives' resources and all that. You can't do that anymore, so you have to make up a new tale. But that's what Vietnam was about. It was about stopping a country developing the way it wanted to develop. And that's what Cuba is about. It's about stopping a country, no matter how small. In fact, as someone famously said, you know, the smaller the adversary, the greater the threat, because if a weak adversary can do it, can oppose the great imperialist US, then anybody can. So this rampaging that has been going on now for God knows how long of the United States, certainly since the Korean War, certainly since the early 1950s, of an imperialist state attacking countries, undermining them, manipulating their financial systems, destroying, subverting their economic systems, and so on and so forth. I hope the world has now had enough of this. You wouldn't know through the media, which itself is, media is probably the best example of imperialism, because the media is owned, the so-called misnamed mainstream is owned basically by the United States and its Western allies. It's an imperialist state. It puts out imperialist propaganda. There's no question about that. Now and then you get a little bit of news that'll come through, but not much. So it's an imperial expression. We're not even allowed to know how each of us really live. That's why I mentioned China. We have no idea, really, how Chinese society lives. We have no idea how Russian society lives. Frankly, we have very little idea how American society lives. We know of all the problems and all the terrible violence and so on, but we don't know how ordinary people live, how they struggle, how they keep their jobs, keep their homes, because there is no news as such. There's no news on a wider sense. The news is part of the imperialism that seeks to rule the world by force. It's very important. I'm sorry if I've gone on a bit about it, Dennis.
Oh, no, no. This is important stuff, John. Please.
Yeah, it's a very important subject, because it's only on programs like yours, and there aren't many like yours, if any, that we will hear this kind of discussion. Otherwise, it's a formula, isn't it? You know, we know it's a formula. We turn it on, and part of our mind just simply adjusts to accept the formula. And I think we deserve better.
I certainly agree with that. The ironies and the questions that are never asked. I mean, I think about, what's her name? Nicole Wallace does 2 hours on MSNBC. Nicole Wallace was the communications director for Bush 2. But if that's not, and so she was the torture justifier. Now she's the liberal on the network. But they just took on Jen Psaki. She went from the press secretary. I'm sorry. She went from the press secretary of Biden and to the MSNBC. No questions asked. No problem. Nobody tells me what to report. You know, how many times have you heard that, John? Nobody tells me what to put in the paper. Oh, yeah? Well, let me see you do a story on Palestine and see how long you last. Yeah. See what kind of byline you get. Will you get the cover? Yeah. I'm sorry.
Absolutely. Look. It's these people are the work of fiction, and they'd be the kind of fiction I'd be very pleased to settle back and read. But unfortunately, I can't because they're not fiction. And at the back of my mind is the knowledge that they actually exist. But where there is so much interest, I think, in humanity, in each other, and there always has been, we've learned from each other. That's just part of being human. And yet now we're said to have the greatest wondrous communication technology that allows us to, that horrible word, connect more than ever. But we're not connecting at all. We're not connecting. We're just, you know, those who have most of this resource of communications simply go on abusing and disinforming the world. That's regressive. It's taking us back. That's why I think the U.S. in so many respects, and I say this quite seriously, is a 19th century country. It hasn't yet struggled into the 20th century. I think probably among what used to be called the intelligentsia, they don't use that word anymore, but I'll use it in the U.S., maybe there is the suspicion that that is true and that other countries are really taking hold of the 21st century. I mean, China's just going ahead, you know, just regardless of what the United States does, is going ahead with this extraordinary rate of development and involving other countries, giving development plans, negotiating development plans with Africa and Latin America and Asia, in return for the resources that they need. This is just going ahead.
How many journalists do you think in Washington would know what AFRICOM is really for, or even if that it's there? You know, like the future of Africa is going to be purchased by the United States.
We don't have maps anymore. What? Yeah. We don't have maps anymore. We only have little phones. So I think they might have trouble finding it on a real map. And impossible to find it on their phone.
But we have the agency AFRICOM, and that was created, right, to suck, just like we did every other hemisphere, to suck the resources out of Africa. The United States of America doesn't care about the humanity in support, in collective action with Africa. This is like research. Would they say, they use words like real estate when they refer to Africa.
Yes, that's right. But mind you, they always did refer to real estate in Asia. They used to talk, you remember, about dominoes, as if countries are great blocks of wood. So yes, real estate. And, you know, all jokes aside, it was Obama, the first black president in the land of slavery, yes, who effectively invaded Africa. He sent into Africa American forces. This was virtually no news at the time. An Africa Command was set up. The Africans didn't want to have much to do with it. Finally, they've given in. I think it's now in Addis Ababa. And so all over Africa, American military to guard the very investments you talk about. You know, Britain has more investments in Africa now than it did at the height of its empire. It, you know, it's as powerful.
Yes.
As even more powerful as it was then. We in the West, have the technology. We have these resources that are needed to exploit the resources, and so we can do this, but we can't do this without looking over our shoulder and seeing the Chinese actually doing it very differently. The Chinese get on very well with the Africans. They go in, they give them soft loans, and the deal is they get some of their resources back and that China needs. And the country ends up having a full six-lane highway or all the bridges that were never built during its colonial time, or a railway line or whatever. So it's not... Mr. Obama's invasion of Africa is not quite going to plan. And that's why they're so very angry about China in Washington.
Well, to put it simply, really, in the macro look, China builds cities and the United States builds weapons. Cities do much better in terms of bringing good feeling, good results back to mother country. That's the point you're making with China. There's that old story, the story, John, about the guy, he's like on the boardwalk at night, late at night, and he's on his knees under the only light. There's only one light there, and he's looking for his keys under that light, and a stranger comes along and says, "What are you doing down there?" He says, "I'm looking for my keys." And the stranger says, "But are you sure you lost them there?" But the guy on his knees says, "No, but this is the only place where there's a light." And the next line is, "So to war." That's all we seem to know. And what comes back from weapons, John?
Yeah.
Body bags.
I mean, the whole. I mean, what the amount of weapons being poured into Ukraine now is just extraordinary. It's not that they'll really be able to do much, because the training that is needed in these, particularly these modern weapons, can take years. But the arms companies are just pouring them in, along with all the other great companies that are exploiting it. I mean, the Shell, I read today that the Shell actually lists on the reasons for its growth in profit without using the word Ukraine, but it uses the word operation, which means that. So, everyone's doing extremely well out of it, particularly the weapons companies. And especially the U.S. Weapons companies. That's something that just hasn't changed. It's fossilized. It just goes on and on. The manufacture of weapons, the selling of weapons. And the moment there is a war, a small war or a big war, here is the opportunity to test them. I filmed in so-called arms fairs, where on the most popular products have had the sign "tested in battle. And the Rock gave the weapons companies an enormous boost. So these are issues that we need to address, but we need a forum in which to address them, and not
yes,
to
a forum. Let me jump in here, John, because this is exactly where I want to go. When's the last time you saw Julian, heard from Julian?
I saw Julian about a month ago, and I spent 2 hours with him in Belmarsh Prison. And I must say I was encouraged by this visit because I felt he was in better shape than when I'd last seen him. I thought his spirits were up. And I discussed this with with his wife, Stella. And of course, as she rightly points out, it can go up and then go terribly down.
Yeah.
But life is a kind of roller coaster of anxiety. I mean, this is true of most people in prison, but I think in Julian's case, where he has this Damocles sword of extradition hanging over his head. So when I've seen him in the past, he hasn't been in good condition. So I have seen him in various I've seen him in various circumstances, and but I was pleased that Julian's resilience, which I've always regarded as remarkable, appears to be working. That he's holding up. That's the best way of describing it, I think.
That's very good news. We are glad to hear that, John, and we're glad that we have all been able to work with Julian, and that he also has a friend like you, and there are people all over this world who understand and recognize the work he's done for the people, for to help all of us think more clearly about the world and how to act inside of it. He really has given a gift, and he created a structure to counteract that which we essentially have been alluding to throughout this hour, is that the flow of information, of clean, clear, crucial, unfettered information, not meant to, prop up a war or a dictator. It's hard to get. And here was somebody who created a way for us to understand more about our world. Am I overstating the case?
Mm-hmm. Well, yes. And he's given us... WikiLeaks gave us information, unfettered information that hadn't been contaminated, hadn't been distorted, and I believe that most people understand that we have a right to that information. We have a right to know. And that's what WikiLeaks provided.
And he was that dangerous that the U.S. intelligence agencies plotted to kill him? What makes him that dangerous?
Yeah, well, that's very dangerous. The truth is always dangerous. As many truth-tellers have learned, truth-telling, whistleblowing, whatever you wish to call it, is a very dangerous occupation, probably the most dangerous, because you'll find against you adversaries that you may not see, you may not hear, but they're there. In Julian's case, of course, once they could get their hands on him, the full scale of his importance and punishment is now happening. The time he spent, he went into Belmarsh prison in April 2019. It feels like, and it feels to him, and it certainly feels to those of us who visited him, to be a much longer sentence, because hanging over him is the prospect of then spending the rest of his life in an American hellhole. And that's a real prospect at the moment. However, he hasn't been extradited. It's still in the courts. It's still grinding its way through an arcane system. So there's still hope.
Just to let people know that, excuse me, there is a new film about the plight of Julian Assange that will be showing in the Bay Area and in different parts of the country. We'll be welcoming Julian's father and brother and some of the entourage, the filmmaker, the folks who worked on that film, and we'll be talking more about that tomorrow on our Flashpoint show with Medea Benjamin, who just happens to be back from Cuba as well. So she's got a lot to say about that trip as well. We're speaking now, and we're honored and really happy to have the chance to speak with John Pilger, who, what's the latest count of how many films you've made, John? I can't count that high.
I counted them last time as 61.
61. And they're 61. All worth... They're all worth seeing. And they're at the... They're now... forgive me, because I don't have all my notes in front of me, but they're now... All your film collection is now stored in Great Britain at the archives, at the National Archives?
Yeah, they're available. Anybody can watch most of them. I simply have to go to my website, johnpilger.com, www.johnpilger.com, go to video, and there they are. I put them up to be available for everybody. And so if people are interested, that's the way to see them. They are. That normal archive is now stored at the British Library in London, but the films are available for watching.
Well, that is terrific. I wish there were as many John Pilgers as there are John Pilger films, because we could use. I would like that, just to see the powers that be run away, because if you had a John Pilger in every country, that would be a good start. But seriously, the plight of journalism, which we hate to talk about, but it's gone crazy. It's gotten absolutely ridiculous, and of course we know at the root of it all is an idiotic school system. You know, where you got governors in America running around carrying the war, putting the, you know, going eye to eye with the woke. we're gonna be woke. Well, we'll make sure we don't wake. John. Yes. Well, what else? Just sort of, you know, as we get ready to say goodbye.
I think we're probably exhausted at the moment.
You know, we get so few shots. I like to take advantage.
Yeah, I'm happy to whenever. Come on as often as you like. Yeah.
That's great, John. That's great. And we are looking forward to bringing the Assanges into town, fighting that fight. Our friend Randy Credico has been unrelenting in his sign campaign,
well,
which has been
Randy
amazing.
Randy's been doing an amazing job with his programs about Julian. Extraordinary, absolutely indefatigable, just wonderful work. So have you, Dennis. There's a small list of honor of people who have kept the Julian Assange story alive, and you're on it, and Randy is, and not many others.
It's amazing how he has been abandoned. Of course, why would, you know, and this is how he slapped me in the face, why would I be surprised that the journalistic community, which has everything to lose, is still willing to abandon him? It sort of reminds me of the way the Republicans cling to the Trumpites. You know, it's like they can't think of anything else to do, so they do the same old, same old. It's insane.
Yeah.
And they can't see they're not journalists. Gotta go crazy.
Yeah.
All right, John, be safe. Take care of yourself. We really appreciate all the time
you
spent with us today.
Yeah.
And
all the very best to you and to your listeners. Thank you, Dennis.
Okay, thank you. You're welcome. It's an honor. Be safe. And Mike, if you're out there, it would be great. We've got a couple of extra minutes. If you want to see if you can curate the next 3 minutes with something wonderful for our ears, I think it would be nice to do that. So, again, you are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and we're going to see if we can go out with some music.
Mama been wraps it up for another episode of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Senior producers are Miguel Gavilan Molina and Kevin Pina. Technical director is Mike Biggs. For previous episodes, go to kpfa.org or flashpoints.net. For questions or comments, email dennis@kpfa.org. Thank you for listening.
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of